listening to Radio Arian. At RadioArian.com.
And welcome to Arian Insights. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I'm very pleased to welcome to us today Mr. Max Masson from Western Spring. Now, Max has been involved in nationalism since the 70s. He's seen the rise of the National Front, the fall of the BNP. He's seen all these political parties begun, and he's basically looked at them and he's come to some different opinions on how things should be done to a lot of these parties. And he's also brought out a recent video of a speech that he gave at the John Tyndall Memorial Meeting that was a really successful speech that a lot of people have viewed it, a lot of people have talked about it, and a lot of people have suggested that we get him on here at Radio Arian. So I'm really pleased that he's here today. And I think we'll start off by going into a little bit of the speech that he gave, and I'll give a link to the video with the article that accompanies this. But the main thrust of the speech itself was about electoral fraud. So if you could begin, Max, possibly by summarizing the opportunities for electoral fraud and explaining just what moral hazard is, please.
Okay. Thanks very much, Sven, and thanks for inviting me on the program. Electoral fraud, is, in my view, a very serious issue, and it's one that isn't addressed at all. The electoral process, the actual mechanics by which our elections are conducted here in the UK, was devised in the late part of the 1800s and has been slightly modified since, but not sort of massively. And the process has within it the potential for it to become a watertight operation. But, in fact, what's happened is that over the decades, it's been, administered in an increasingly sloppy way so that, there is now massive scope for electoral fraud to take place. I first became aware of this, when I was an organizer for the British National Party. I became a candidate. I was an agent for other people who were candidates. I was a polling agent. I was a counting agent. And so I fulfilled all of the roles that are involved in actually conducting an election on behalf of a political party. And one of the things that I realized was that, as I say, the process is administered in a very sloppy way. So to begin with, what happens at the beginning of polling day is that before the polling station opens, the polling agents that are acting on behalf of the various candidates should be invited into the polling station to check that ballot boxes are empty before they start being filled. And this is something which rarely actually happens. What often happens is that the polling station opens promptly, and if there are any polling agents outside, they are able to wander in, but the ballot box has already been sealed by the staff of the polling station. So apart from just shaking the ballot box, it's difficult to actually tell whether the ballot box is empty or not. And I would say that in the vast majority of cases, people who are polling agents are intimidated into actually not even checking to that extent, because the staff at polling stations have their way of going about things, and they don't really like to have representatives of political parties, much less representatives of nationalist political parties, actually questioning the way that they go about things. The seals that they use to seal the tops on the ballot boxes should be, in my view, numbered seals, so that at the beginning of the day, everybody concerned, all of the polling agents, should be able to take a note of the numbers of the seals to make sure that when the ballot boxes reach the count at the end of the day, that they can check the numbers to make sure that those seals haven't been broken, to make sure that nobody has actually interfered with the contents of the ballot box. But as I say, the seals aren't numbered, that are used by the polling station staff. The seals are blank, which means they can break the seals and open the ballot box at any time of the day that they choose. And my experience is that they do, at least occasionally, open the ballot boxes, because I've actually wandered into a polling station and found the staff of that station with the top off of the ballot box, ostensibly squashing down the ballot papers that are in the box in order to make room for more people to vote. But that's something that they shouldn't actually do. But they're able to do it, and they're able to reseal the boxes with blank seals, so that nobody is any the wiser at the end of the day. At the end of the day, when polling finishes, when I was a boy, I can recall the ballot boxes being transported from the polling stations to the count in the boots of police cars or in security corps vans. But nowadays, what happens is that the boxes are simply carried out to their private cars by the staff who have manned the polling station. They're put into the boot of their cars, and there may be two or three or four ballot boxes from the same polling station, and they may all go into the boot of different cars and all get driven off, a while later those cars will arrive at the count, and they'll be and the ballot boxes will be taken out of the boot and will be carried into the counting hall. Now, because the seals aren't numbered, nobody will know when the boxes arrive at the count whether the boxes have been opened, from the point where they left the polling station to the point where they actually arrive at the counting hall, because they could have been popped open and the contents of the boxes could have been tampered with and they could have been resealed. Similarly, there's no way of knowing that the ballot box is even the same ballot box that left the polling station. It could be an entirely different ballot box that's been substituted, that's been full of fraudulently produced ballot papers. The last thing is that when the counting agents and the candidates of the various parties arrive at the count, they're usually held outside by security staff and they're not allowed in until a given time. And when they do go into the counting hall, what they find is that all of the ballot boxes have already been broken open and all of the seals have been broken. So even in situations where a political party has used its own numbered seals, those seals are usually broken, and there's no way of knowing whether they were broken just prior to people wandering into the counting hall or whether they've been broken at some earlier time. So there's no way of knowing, again, whether the contents of the ballot boxes have been tampered with. And this, in my view, is a very serious thing, because it means that the public really can have no confidence in the voting system. Now, the principle of moral hazard that I spoke about in the speech is one which is derived from my time at banking, where the principle of moral hazard asserts that if somebody is placed in a position where they have the capacity to commit an illegal act which will be to their benefit, in circumstances where nobody will ever find out, and if they're habitually exposed to that risk, then they will eventually succumb to the temptation to commit the illegal act and thereby benefit from it. And so as far as banks are concerned, all of their internal processes are designed in such a way that everybody knows that there are checks that are conducted periodically, which will expose if they've actually been embezzling any money. And if those checks weren't there, then, or if those checks have been shown to have been in any way inadequate, then the bank will assume that if that situation has existed for any length of time, that money must have been embezzled. So on the basis of the principle of moral hazard, we must assume that because our political establishment are repeatedly exposed to the temptation of immorally interfering with and illegally interfering with the contents of ballot boxes, and are exposed to the temptation to switch ballot boxes and to commit electoral fraud in circumstances where nobody will ever find out, we must assume that it's being done. And once you assume that it is being done, it then explains to a great extent why nationalist candidates and their electoral workers very often have found that when they've been canvassing an area where a nationalist candidate has been standing, that they've had widespread support from the public, and people at the door have been saying, oh yes, you can count on us, we'll vote for you. But then at the end of the day, when the votes are counted, the number of votes for nationalist candidates are much, much less than the number of people that have promised to do so on the door. And electoral fraud of this sort would explain why that happens.
So if there's a chance that people will cheat, then there's a chance that they have cheated, and you must assume that they have actually cheated. Has this ever been brought up to the authorities at all? Have you brought this up to the authorities or anyone else you know of that's done that at all?
Well, when I was, as I say, an organiser for the BNP, I was aware of the fact that the BNP were very concerned about this, and the BNP did actually challenge a number of elections where they were very disappointed with the outcome of the election. The BNP went to the extent of issuing organisers with numbered seals that we could use during elections so that we could seal the boxes. But even on occasions when we've used numbered seals, I've still found that when the boxes have arrived at the counting hall, prior to the our staff being allowed into the counting hall and prior to the candidates being allowed into the counting hall, all of the seals have been broken open. And then when I've spoken to the returning officer concerned, the returning officer just shrugs and says, well, you're the only person that's concerned with this. Everybody else seems to be quite happy with the process. You know, what's your beef? And so as an individual, I was then left with a situation where I could pursue a formal complaint, which would be, in my experience, time consuming and which would actually produce no result, because it's a bit like going up to a policeman and asking the policeman whether he's a corrupt policeman or an honest policeman. And obviously the answer is going to be, well, you know, I'm an honest policeman. Unless you actually can appeal to a higher authority, there's nothing more that you can do. And there is no higher authority than our current political establishment.
And they're the ones that could be doing the cheating. It's like they can hardly investigate themselves, can they? And it wouldn't take many places for this to be done, for it to alter the result. It wouldn't have to be over the whole country. It would just have to be in the places where it mattered, where the nationalist candidates were looking like they could be winning.
That's quite right. That's one of the points that I made in my speech, that the response that I often get when I explain this to people is, well, what are you saying, that everybody that works for a local authority in their polling office or their electoral office is actually involved in a massive fraud? You know, that can't possibly be the case because I know somebody, blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is, as you've just explained, it doesn't happen to have to happen anywhere, or everywhere rather. It only needs to happen in the wards that are critical to the success of a candidate that the establishment wouldn't want to get elected. And so it only has to happen in a very small number of cases for it to be effective on a wide scale.
Was it this that finally made you despair of the electoral process, or was it a culmination of events that caused that to happen?
Well, it was partly this. It was more a realisation that unless you are part of an organisation that's strong enough to seriously challenge the political establishment, the political establishment aren't going to seriously take any notice of what you say. And so a nationalist political party can make a formal complaint to the Electoral Commission about these sort of things, but the Electoral Commission won't actually be motivated to do anything, really effective, unless there is a consequence to them not doing anything. And the consequence has to be something that they would take seriously. And so, for example, if a nationalist political party had sufficient numbers of militant members such that if there was no response to their legitimate challenge, those people would appear on the streets and would demonstrate vigorously and not go away until such time as the issue was addressed, then there is a chance that the establishment might react and take some steps to actually make the electoral process a little bit more solid and a little bit more dependable. But in my view, in situations where you challenge the the establishment where you have no power, then they effectively just take you through a very prolonged process of inquiry, during which they hope to wear you down through attrition, and then they come back and just say sorry, shrug and say sorry, you know, we don't agree, we're not going to do anything. An example of this was a Christmas about 6 or 7 years ago, when I was doing some Christmas shopping in a bookshop, and I discovered a copy of a book called Stupid White Men by I can't remember the guy's first name now. Moore. He's a director in the United States. I can't remember what his first name is now. But anyway, I came across this book called Stupid White Men and flicked through it because I was a bit startled by the title of the book, and came upon chapter 4, which was entitled Kill Whitey. And in this book, the author describes how white people are the source of all the world's ills, how white people have abused black people and non-white people for so long that black people and non-white people can be excused for any wish to physically abuse white people and perhaps even murder and kill white people, and that the way to resolve this is for every white person to ensure that their children marry and interbreed with non-white people so that the white race ceases to exist. And I then took this book to the manager of the bookshop and complained about it and told him that it was race hate literature and that it was illegal for him to distribute this kind of thing. And he, Michael Moore, that's the name of the person who was the author of the book, Michael Moore, I explained that it was race hate literature, that I gave him the opportunity not to be cited in my complaint that I was subsequently going to make to the police. He then said that he was under orders that he had to sell all of the books he was supplied with. He couldn't take them off the shelves. And I went around a number of bookshops and performed the same process in every bookshop, and then went to the police, presented the evidence to the police. The police officers that I spoke to agreed that, yes, this looked like race hate material. It was definitely anti-white and discriminated against white people on the basis of our race. But at the end of the day, they just shrugged and said, but they weren't prepared to do anything about it. I then continued to complain to the police, and eventually one police officer took me seriously and took me to a race hate unit here in Northampton, where I made a formal complaint. I then composed a 12-page report, which I then sent on to the Crown Prosecution Service in York, I think it was, and they considered it and mulled it over for a period of around about 8 or 9 months, and then wrote back and said that they weren't going to do anything because Michael Moore's book couldn't be considered to be racist because Michael Moore is a white man.
And of course, if you'd had a large pressure group behind you, then you may have had a bit more success with it rather than just being one individual. Was that sort of inspired you to begin Western Spring then? Because part of the 6 prerequisites that we're going to get to later is forming this mass of people that can be mobilized to support causes like this.
Well, that itself wasn't what motivated me to help form Western Spring. What happened was that in, I think it was 2000 and from about 2009 onwards, I started to become disenchanted with things that were happening within the BNP, and it was in 2011 that my colleague Matt Tate took the initiative and invited a number of people who live in the Midlands and the North Home Counties to a series of meetings that we conducted in London, where we initially addressed the issue. We brainstormed what we thought was wrong with the BNP at the time. And then, as a result of the discussions that we had, we widened it to brainstorming what we thought was wrong with nationalism, because although there were specific things that were wrong with the BNP, there were other specific things that affected all nationalist political parties. And so, as I say, we widened the discussion and then came to conclusions that a new kind of organisation was needed, one which primarily wasn't going to be a political party.
So this is why it's not structured like a political party then. That was a question that somebody asked, was why it wasn't structured like a political party.
Well, that's right. It isn't structured like a political party because, first of all, because of the corruption that exists within the electoral system, in terms of the scope for electoral fraud that we've already spoken about, and also because of the fact that the Equalities Act has created a situation in which every public body has a duty to actively combat what is viewed by them as racism. And part of that is that they require any private organisations that have contractual arrangements with those public bodies to also have a formal policy of combating what they see as racism. And so, and that effectively has created a totalitarian state here in the UK in which it is almost impossible to function properly within our society if you hold dissident views with regard to race, because your job becomes is placed under threat, your career is placed under threat, your ability to win contracts if you're a business person with the local authority or with any other government body is under threat constantly, and also with regard to the mass media and every facet of our society, from top to bottom, there is now a culture that's been created which is hostile to the values and the principles underpinning nationalism. And so when you combine those two things, the scope for electoral fraud with that poisoning of the political, socio-political environment in which we operate, it means that it's the chance of nationalist candidates getting elected is very slight indeed. And the numbers that do get elected are very small and sporadic. And this environment means, well, this is the outcome of this environment. The environment means that nationalist political parties will never get sufficient numbers of candidates elected, or candidates elected with any regularity such that they will ever acquire political power. And obviously, that is the objective of our political establishment, to make sure that we never acquire any political power. So it becomes pointless us being a political party until we achieve a situation where we're able to challenge the political establishment in a non-parliamentary way. And that means that we need to acquire what I refer to in my writing as the six prerequisites.
We need to work our way around, really, this ban on public organisations from advocating for white interests. So your way of doing this with Western Spring is a way of working around that and not being a public body, but still getting the people together to support that when it happens, I would say. Have you got any international affiliations with other groups? Because there are similar groups. I mean, I'm thinking of the Northwest Front in America. They're a non-political organization that are seeking to gather numbers and get enough people together to in one particular area. I know that part of the prerequisites is to establish these basic white enclaves that people can go to for support, and that can also be used to mobilize once we've got enough people. So are you affiliated with any other international groups at all?
We're not formally affiliated with any other international groups. I am aware of the Northwest Front, and I suppose some inspiration has been drawn from them. Although it's not our intention to copy exactly what they do. I would say that with regard to them, they are looking at creating a new state out of four of the states of the United States of America, and each one of those states is very, very large in comparison with Britain. So the tactics and the strategy that they are employing will be on an entirely different scale to what we would be doing here in the UK. Also, the Northwest Front, a lot of the inspiration for the Northwest Front comes from novels that have been written by Harold Covington, which explicitly state that that there will need to be a war of independence where the Northwest Front declares independence and then fights against the United States government. And our outlook is that need not necessarily be the case, and certainly shouldn't be the desired case here in the UK. We would always wish to pursue our ends by legitimate and constitutional means. However, I think anybody viewing the slow decline of Britain can see that Britain is declining into an eventual third world status, and all of the current social trends are taking us towards third world status, because if you fill a country up with people from the third world, then that it becomes a third world country. And so as Britain becomes more and more of a third world country, then the ability of the government to actually govern, the ability of the government to control what happens throughout Britain will slowly diminish, and the British government will take on the same character as, say, the government of Pakistan, where they don't actually have control of all the country because there are so many local warlords and criminal gangs that hold power in the more provincial parts of the country. And I can see that kind of a chaotic situation developing here in the UK, where, to be quite blunt about it, the ability for anybody to conduct a free and fair election will be taken out of everybody's hands, including the hands of the government. And in that kind of chaotic situation, a political organisation and a movement of national salvation will have to use whatever means are necessary in order to re-establish peace and control over the country.
So the more they push it, the more chaotic it gets, the more immigration there is, the more chance there is of revolution and civil war, and it will be down to them rather than down to us, because we've tried the legitimate means, been trying the legitimate means for years, and they're the ones that keep pushing the conditions towards the civil war. But if I'll just let the listeners know what these six prerequisites are, and then we'll discuss them, I think.
Okay.
We've got, I'll read them off. A minimum of 650 MP quality local leaders and activists who will potentially be our candidates in an election. Number two, white enclaves, at least one in every constituency across the country, that will provide community power bases and our core voters and supporters. Number three, a network of friends who will be our fifth column within the existing political establishment. Number four, a nationalist media composed of at least one TV station and a vast interlocking network of internet websites. Number five, a large body of militant street activists. And finally, number six, a war chest of £100 million. That's quite some amount there at the end there. So the first question I've got here, which again comes from one of our listeners, and he says, why are the six prerequisites so important? Bit of a simple one, this, I think.
Yeah, the six prerequisites are so important because, by definition, a prerequisite is something you have to have in order for something to happen. And however you look at it, whether you are leading a political organisation that is an electioneering political organisation, or whether you're leading an organisation which has some other plan to achieve power, the fact of the matter is that those six prerequisites will be necessities if you are to have a chance of achieving political power, if you have a chance of successfully challenging for political power. Without those six things, you will not succeed. And some people respond when I talk about the six prerequisites as if this is something that we just, you know, these are just six things that we thought of that came off the top of our heads, and that we chose six because it's the same number of eggs that you get in a small egg basket, or the same number of cans that you get in a six pack. and that's not the case. What happened is we approached it from the point of view of a shopping basket of things that a nationalist organization would need if it was to achieve political power. And it just so happens there happen to be six of these things. And in terms of just discussing them, we need to have people who are capable of spreading the word across the country. And the title that I give the people that are involved in prerequisite one changes depending upon the the precise role, because they will be people who will need to multitask and who will need to be very high caliber people indeed. But these are people that will be required to go out across the country and effectively evangelize, to sell our story, to make people want to join and to recruit people into our organization. And by through that process of recruiting people into our organization, the evangelists will increase the flow of contributions into our organization, and as a reward for increasing the flow of contributions into our organization, they will be paid an income which is proportionate to the level of contributions that they attract, so that they will have the ability to become full-time activists. And this again is one of the key factors to this, that we need our activists to be full-time activists, so that they're not distracted by the need to fulfill a daytime job, and they can devote themselves 100% to the cause and to building our organization. And one of the problems that we found with the with nationalist political parties is that if you take an average BNP organizer, for example, who will be male, because most of them are, he will go out and he will do a full day's work and come home, and at the end of the day he will need to pay some attention to his wife, otherwise he'll end up in the divorce courts. He'll need to pay some attention to his children, otherwise his children will go off the rails. He'll need to do some DIY around the house, in the car, in the garden, all this sort of thing. And then in the small amount of time that he has left, the party expected him then to go out and organize leafleting in order to find new members. And then once the leafleting had been done and responses to the leafleting had come in, then the organizer was then expected to go out and to convert those inquiries into new members. And the fact of the matter is that somebody who is fulfilling a full-time job and who is a father and a family man just cannot spare the time to do that properly. And so what they either do is they do the work of building the party properly. They give that the priority, in which case they don't fulfill the requirements of their job and run the risk of losing their job, or they don't pay sufficient attention to their wife and family, in which case they end up in a divorce court. And once those sort of things happen, once you lose your job, once you end up in a divorce court, then obviously your eyes are not going to be on the ball when it comes to continuing to build the party. And so this is one of the vicious cycles that people got into within the British National Party, which meant that the party eventually wasn't successful. If we go on to the enclaves, the primary reason for thinking about enclaves was to create an environment in which nationalist families could live in a way in which they weren't under constant attack. And by that, what I mean is that if we go back to the fictitious organizer that I was just talking about there, his children would be going to school where they would be spending 8 hours a day under the indoctrination of teachers who would be teaching them values and teaching them principles that are derived from the national curriculum. And that person would probably at best have just half an hour of quality time with his children each day, and so therefore it wouldn't be surprising that if on average the children of nationalist activists actually grow up with values that are entirely different to the values of their parents, and therefore don't follow their parents into supporting and building the nationalist organizations that their parents have devoted their lives to. And one of the things that we need to do is we need to create communities of white people that first of all reproduce above replacement rates, so that we're producing more children, so that with each generation our numbers are growing, and that they live in environments whereby their children grow up believing the same as they believe, so that the numbers of nationalists will increase biologically in the same way. And so one of the purposes of the enclaves was to do that. But it also then dovetails in with what needs to be done in order for us to acquire political power. And if we can create enclaves and have sufficient concentrations of our people in those enclaves so that we can control the boards of governors of the local schools so that we can control the local neighbourhood watch, the residents associations, the parish council. Then we'll have control of things like the civic amenities in that village. And if we have sufficient concentrations of people so that we can determine who has the local businesses, and so therefore if there is a landlord of a local pub who is hostile to us, then by boycotting the pub, if we can bankrupt that landlord and then replace him with somebody who is sympathetic to us, then it means that slowly we will take over all of the businesses in a particular village, or at least all of the businesses will eventually be run by people who are sympathetic to our aims. And if we can increase our numbers and expand the geographic spread of the enclave, making it larger and larger as time goes on, and if we help to create further enclaves in neighbouring villages and they grow and expand, and because they expand, they coalesce into larger and larger areas, then eventually we could see the growth of all white enclaves that perhaps cover half a county, where they are large enough to determine who gets elected to Parliament. They would certainly be large enough to determine who gets elected to local authorities, and so there we would therefore be able to gain some representation through those political institutions. And ultimately, if you project that that rate of that kind of growth, that organic growth, forward in time, a situation could develop where our enclaves expand to cover the bulk of the country, in which case we'd be in a very strong position when it comes to challenging the current political establishment and forcing them to institute a more robust electoral system that we would then have a chance of winning.
So is there a particular reason then why you've spread them out into these separate ones around the country rather than sort of concentrating in one area and trying to get everyone to coalesce in this one area? I mean, one reason why I could think why it's preferable to have it dotted about is because it would be easier for people to move to somewhere within their own sphere of influence rather than moving quite some distance to one area miles away from their friends and family. I mean, that's one reason why I could think of having them dotted about. But is there a particular reason why you're not just concentrating on one area?
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, part of the thinking we had initially was that we would try and concentrate everybody in one area, but getting people to move from one end of the country to the other, particularly when you've not got a particularly large organisation yet, so that there is no immediate tangible benefit to them in moving to that area, it is very difficult. And so if we were in a situation where we already had an area of entire villages that were our enclave, such that there was a discernible difference between the enclave and the area surrounding it, then people would be more inclined to move in order to enjoy that. But in the early formative stages, it isn't possible to do that. And so it's far better for us to try and create the enclaves in areas where we already have some concentrations of nationalists, and so that makes it all over the country.
Do you still see the acquiring a television station as essential with the rapid changes that have been happening to people's viewing habits? You know, they view on demand rather than scheduled viewing. So you wouldn't be able to sneak in the nationalist content alongside the more mainstream content because people just sort of download on demand. So do you still see that as essential with these changes that are happening?
Well, I think that whilst people do view specific television programmes on demand, people still turn on the television to watch the news, there is still quite a sizable proportion of the population, particularly the older sections of the population, who still habitually view television in the traditional way. And if you have a television station, and what I envisage us acquiring in this respect is an internet-based television station that just broadcasts 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year. If you create a situation where people can view it passively rather than having to actively seek out the programs that contain the content that they want, then people always habitually tend to take the line of least resistance. And so I think people will, particularly if they discover a very good television program, a television station rather, which is internet based, that they can watch for free, they don't have to have a television license, then that's an added incentive for people to watch that television station and absorb the values that are projected in the same way that they tend to absorb the values that are projected from terrestrial TV stations.
Well, that's pretty much what we're trying to do with Radio Aryan, is provide content for people so they don't have to go out searching for it and varying it. But I think you've got a very good point there about the news. And the Daily Stormer has been a really successful media site because it concentrates on the news. It's as successful and gets as many viewers as Stormfront does. So the next step on from that will be to produce nationalist news, which I'm not aware that there is any actual televisual nationalist news. But I would say that should be the next step that people should be concentrating on, is producing a weekly news program or a daily news program that would appeal to the mainstream as well as to nationalists. I think that would be the next step, just listening to you there.
I would say the most important thing in the development of it, I appreciate things that you've just said and what you've just said about Daily Stormer is absolutely true, but I think that the key that will make the quantum leap forward will be when we're able to produce entertainment programs that people want to watch. If we can create a nationalist television company that doesn't call itself the nationalist television company, but just calls itself something like, I keep coming to the word Aurora, but I don't know why, but Aurora TV, for example. If you created a TV station called Aurora TV and it just produced news programs which weren't labeled as nationalist news, if it produced comedy programs, children's programs, documentaries, if it, under license, broadcast television programs that have been made by the terrestrial TV companies, but which have got content which we feel is appropriate, and so it was able to have a full gamut of TV programs which fill the entire 24 hours, so that somebody coming home from work in the evening, instead of switching on terrestrial TV and having that going as like the background noise while they're cooking their evening meal and coming and just sort of sitting down on the sofa and watching it, if they just had their computer in the corner with a nice big 50-inch screen and it was tuned into Aurora TV on the internet, and so it was free, as I say, and they could come home and switch it on and just have it going in exactly the same way, and it would have exactly the same propaganda and mental conditioning effect that the current corrupt TV programs have.
Well, yeah, there have been quite a few stealth websites popping up just lately. There's one called the Info Hub. I think I saw one last night called Tidbits, with non-nationalist names that has non-nationalist content on there, but then it's got nationalist content all dotted around with it. So you've got links to alternative news, but you've also got links to alternative nationalist sites. But it doesn't come underneath the nationalist name, which I thought was a pretty clever way of doing things. This is sort of, It's all similar idea, but expressing it in different ways. Well, the next thing I wanted to know is, what has been the reaction to all this from the nationalist political parties or other nationalist groups?
The reaction to it has tended to be negative, I would say. There have been some nationalist groups that have responded to it positively, but I would say in the main the response has tended to be negative. And it's largely down to the fact that people are, for one thing, creatures of habit, and so that they like to do things that they feel comfortable doing. And so I think a number of people who are very long-term nationalist campaigners have kind of created a comfort zone for themselves where they don't like what's going on in the country and they want to feel that they're doing something. And so they've decided that the one thing they can do, the one thing that they're allowed to do legally, is to campaign and stand in elections. And so they just campaign and stand in elections and get a paltry share of the vote each time, but each time say, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if one day everybody woke up? But they don't have to take responsibility for the fact that people don't wake up. They can just shrug their shoulders and say, well, you know, I did everything that I could. But in reality, what they're doing is that they're doing what they choose to do, and not doing the thing that is most effective, because as we've already established, standing in elections is completely ineffective. And so therefore, if what you're doing is standing in elections, then you're as good as doing nothing. And the same goes to a certain extent for groups who simply demonstrate in the street. The act of demonstrating in the street can be effective. And it can have other benefits, but by and large, most of the street demonstrations that take place by nationalist groups are carried out by such small groups that they have very little public impact. They're carried out by such small groups that they are very often dwarfed by the left opposition that turned up. They are very often dwarfed by the police that turn up, and the police then kettle them and shuffle them into some little backwater somewhere where they can have a bit of a rant, but nobody's actually going to hear them and nobody's going to get offended, and then they're dispersed and sent home. And so again, if you are a member of one of these nationalist groups and there is no tangible benefit coming from the activities that you're engaged in, then you've got to seriously question whether you continue doing that or whether you do something which has the potential to change our circumstances in the future. I mean, one of the benefits that comes from having street demonstrations is that young guys are exposed to an element of danger, because there's always the danger of confrontation with leftist thugs. And in carrying out street demonstrations, they can help to develop the kind of leadership skills and the kind of camaraderie that was developed by people who were involved in the two world wars of the last century, where if you face danger together, it is a bonding experience. And if you are somebody who is seen to be able to organize things well and you organize a demonstration rather like a military exercise, and you're able to demonstrate that you can organize a demonstration with military precision, then that is a good thing from the point of view of building up a core of people who could be the nucleus of the street army that I talk about, which is prerequisite number 5.
Yeah, I always think the audacious stunts, daring stunts, are the things that need to be done, like the League of Empire Loyalists used to get up to, so that you get lots of maximum publicity and exposure with using a minimum amount of people. So maybe banner drops over bridges, banner drops on cranes, videos, funny videos where you turn up like Nordfront did, where they turned up in Sweden in a posh district, blaring out the Muslim call to prayer, saying we're bringing diversity to your district. That sort of thing, I think, is more effective than a small group shouting, as you're saying, on a street corner. Even though that provides the camaraderie and it may help with finding leaders for the future, it doesn't look too impressive to the public. Now, the next thing that I was going to ask was, do you think these nationalist groups should be toning it down or being more racially focused? Do you think that?
Okay, well, before I come to that, let me just add a little bit more to what you've just been saying. I think you're absolutely correct in that. And what I would say is that nationalist groups that specialize in street demonstrations, rather than have a fixed demonstration where they are turning up at a pre-arranged time, so that they can be sure that the leftist opposition and the police are going to be also turning up at the same time. What they need to do is to develop a format which is, what's the term? It's just gone clean out of my head now. Flash demonstrations. They need to demonstrate flash demonstration. They need to work through flash demonstrations where they turn up, put on a very elaborate and theatrical display, which has high impact with people, conduct it for a period of time during and the length of time that it's conducted for will be a carefully judged thing in order to wrap the whole thing up and move on before the police arrive or before any sizable amounts of leftist opposition arrive. And I think if our nationalist groups were to specialise in those kind of flash demonstrations, firstly, it would enable them to demonstrate where there is no leftist opposition, so therefore they would have the complete attention of anybody who was within earshot or view of what they were doing, and they could conduct the flash demonstration in a way which required far less thought and preparation with regard to security, because you would know that there would be a negligible amount of antipathy from the average crowd of British people that might see it and might be entertained by it, and those kind of demonstrations offer far more scope for developing the kind of planning and execution and leadership skills that will be of greater benefit as time goes by. Going to the question that you subsequently asked, which is with regard to should we become more racially focused? I think that we probably are racially focused enough, and I think that a focus on race is very important because it's essential to our underlying ideology. I think the thing that needs to be done most, though, with nationalist groups is simply to polish up our presentation skills, because people aren't the more educated and erudite and the more polished the way in which we present, the more impressed people who are uncommitted will be. The cruder the way in which we present our arguments, the less impressed people who aren't already committed will be. And so therefore, I think it's the way in which we impart our knowledge, the way in which we make our arguments, that is going to be the key thing. But I think that that we do need to keep a keen focus on race, because it is the most important element of our ideology.
So it's very important that we put across a professional standard, basically, is what you're saying.
That's right. Well, one of the things that I've been criticised for in the past is talking about salesmanship, and that there's a general view amongst lots of people that salesmen are people who've got the gift of the gab and that they are silver-tongued snake oil salesman, and it's this kind of an idea. But I'm not suggesting that nationalists should become silver-tongued snake oil salesmen. What I'm suggesting is that we take advantage of the benefits of being able to sell. And so the study of the principles of persuasion is a very valuable thing for any aspiring nationalist activist to engage in, and getting practice at presenting, getting practice at persuading people, finding out what actually motivates somebody is very, very important. And quite often when you if you go and see somebody and you sit down in their lounge to talk to them about joining your organization, what you will find is that the mistake that people very often make is that they think that they've got to tell that person all about the organization. And so they just start from A in the alphabet and just work their way through telling that person everything they know about the organization. And they just talk away for perhaps an hour, during which time they are probably for a large part of that hour talking about things that aren't really of any great importance to the person they're talking to. And one of the essential things that you learn if you've ever spent any time as a salesperson is you've got to find out what that person wants and what it is that makes them interested in what you've got to sell. And so you sit down and you say to them, what is it that first attracted you to nationalism? what is it that first attracted, made you interested in our organization? And then you just sit and you listen to what they have to say, and they will tell you all the things that they think are the most important. And once they've told you all the things that are the most important, you then just pick each one of those item by item, and you go through and show them how that thing that they think is important is served by them joining your organization. And the next thing that they think is important is also served by them joining your organization. And you just work through all of the things that they feel are most important. And at the end of that, that they will be sold on the idea. And they'll think that you've given them the opportunity to speak. They will feel good about the fact that you've listened to what they have to say, and they'll feel good about your organization and they'll join.
Well, that's an excellent bit of advice there for all advocates, I think. Okay, well, that brings me to the next question. After talking about race and becoming racially focused, do you think highlighting the Jewish problem is beneficial or not?
Yes and no. And the reason why I say that is that I think it's important for us to expose the adverse impact that organized minorities have within our society. And I've written a number of articles about this where I refer to a phenomenon which I call organized minority advantage, which is an advantage that an organized minority gains if they live and work and trade and operate within a loosely cohesive host community. And the social dynamics of a multicultural society are such that ethnic minorities inevitably get drawn into behaving as organized minorities. And those members of ethnic minorities who don't get involved in acting as an organized minority are left outside of their organized minorities, and they effectively become part of the host community as well. And they suffer from the organized activities of the organized minorities in the same way that the host community does. So the impetus for them is for them not to suffer. So they will seek advantage and therefore join their minority groups in the organizations that they have. And as far as the Jews are concerned, the Jewish community in this country is an organized minority. Not all Jews are active within that organized minority. Some of them are only active to a limited degree, but other Jews are active to a great degree. And that doesn't mean to say that the activities of organized minorities are evil per se, or are malignant per se, but the overall impact of somebody who is part of a host community where there are organized minorities operating within their country is one that the average member of the host community suffers. And it's very easy for people who are members of organized minorities to financially benefit disproportionately, and that disproportionate financial benefit comes at the expense of the people who compose the host community. In fact, an organized minority doesn't even have to be racially different from the host community. An organized minority need only be a Masonic organization. And when I say that, I'm not saying that all Masonic organizations are intrinsically evil or bad, but a Masonic organization is one where the people involved in that organization operate an in-group, out-group approach to all of their dealings, whereby they give preference to people who are part of their in-group at the expense of people who are part of the out-group. And this is the way in which organized minorities, whether they are an organized minority which is Masonically based or an organized minority which is based around an ethnic minority, it's the way that they will operate. Now, as far as Jews are concerned, Jews are mistakenly labeled by a lot of people within nationalism as things equivalent to the devil's spawn, they're regarded as being the enemy of all mankind, and all these kind of things get said by people that I've heard. And in reality, that's a misinterpretation of the situation. All that people within the Jewish community are doing is that they are living their lives as part of an organized minority, and as I say, the social dynamics are such that an organized minority that operates within a loosely cohesive host community will disproportionately benefit at the expense of the members of the host community. The difference between Jews and other minority, organized minorities is that Jews have been an organized minority within Western nations for much, much longer than any of the others. They've become very skilled at it, very polished at benefiting by operating as an organized minority. And that's it really. I don't subscribe to the view that Jews are uniquely evil or that they are intrinsically evil people. They're just doing what organized minorities do when they live within a loosely cohesive host community, in the same way that there is developing around the Asian community, there's developing around the West Indian community in this country, all of the various facets of an organized minority, because each one of those ethnic or racial groups is inevitably and irresistibly being drawn into organizing on that basis, because that's what the social dynamics of a multicultural society forces them to do.
So they've been doing it for the longest. That's why they're most effective at it. We also see the Muslims doing it. We also see the homosexuals doing it now with their separate community. And what are your views on accepting Jews or homosexuals or mulattoes into nationalism? What are Western Spring's views on that?
It varies very much according to the individual. I wrote an article actually some time ago, which is entitled "The Homosexual Question," where I dealt with the subject of homosexuality fairly comprehensively. And if anybody's interested in that particular issue, then I would advise them to do a search on our website and find it and have a read of it. I mean, basically, my position with regard to homosexuals is that homosexuality is a naturally occurring abnormality. My belief is that homosexuals have played a role in the evolution of mankind in the past, and that is the reason why homosexuality is predominantly a genetically caused condition. It's genetically caused through the action of, in my view, a number of recessive genes. And those recessive genes are present in everybody, but not in sufficient numbers, in sufficient concentrations to make most people homosexual. They exist such that in every generation of people, whether it's a generation within a society where homosexuality is promoted, or whether it's or tolerated, or whether it's a generation within a society where homosexuality is persecuted and penalized, there will always be a number of homosexuals that will be born by the simple mechanics of reproduction in a situation where those genes happen by chance to be thrown together in a sufficient quantity in one individual person. And so, for example, the proof of that is that even in societies where homosexuality is banned and where homosexuals are executed for sexual deviancy, there are still homosexuals that occur in subsequent generations. And in view of the fact that homosexuals can't have children, it can't be a matter of it being a dominant gene which is causing it. It's got to be a matter that there is a recessive gene which just causes it to reoccur in each generation in a small minority of people. And if it occurs in a small minority of people and those people recognize the fact that they are a naturally occurring abnormality within society, and they practice their homosexuality as consenting adults in private, then I've got no beef with them whatsoever. I think that that's a perfectly acceptable way for somebody who discovers they're homosexual for them to behave. What I have an issue with regard to homosexuals is where they become militant and try to promote homosexuality as something which is either normal or desirable. And so you end up with these really lurid gay pride parades and things of this sort where they just cavort in public in a very immodest way and a way which is unseemly and not healthy.
So it has to be judged on the individual basis. You answered one of my questions there. I was thinking when you were talking about the homosexuality being genetic, I was thinking, well, how can it be passed on if homosexuals don't usually produce children? But you were saying that it's a recessive gene that's in everybody, and it's just by chance it's switched on in some people and not others. And there is some evidence to show that it can happen in the womb. There's hormones, hormone changes and imbalances that happen in the womb that could be causing this. It could be causing this increase of homosexuality. But instead of dealing with it and trying to prevent that, our twisted government seems to just wish to promote it and encourage it all the more. And as you were saying there about homosexuals, if it was kept indoors, it was their business, nobody else's, then there wouldn't be so much of a problem with it. It is the flaunting of it and the teaching of it as being a desirable way to be and making it out to be a lifestyle when it's really an aberration, an abnormal behaviour. Okay, well, what about Jews and mulattoes then, being members of nationalism or specifically as part of Western Spring? What are your views on that?
Right, well, true nationalism, in my view, is by definition racially based. And as such, it's inconsistent with the tenets of white nationalism to accept as members of our community people who are non-white or from a standpoint of group identity clearly are compromised as a result of a significant non-white racial heritage. In my view, if someone looks white, if they act white, if they self-identify as white, and there's nothing about them that suggests that they're anything other than white, then we should accept them as white, even if subsequently there's a small non-white component in their ancestry that we discover. In a nationalist society and under a nationalist government, my belief is that any undesirable genes that still exist within our gene pool can be eliminated through gene therapy and through humane eugenic programs of the sort that would be used in any healthy society to eliminate hereditary diseases or deformities. And I think these matters, where somebody's got a trace of non-white ancestry, can be dealt with humanely and sympathetically without any embarrassment or stigma as far as that person's concerned. And certainly without any of the harsh measures that have previously been attributed to past eugenic programs.
So how would you mean by doing that? By getting mulattoes to breed with other mulattoes, basically make sure that they didn't contaminate the white gene pool?
Well, one thing that I would want a future nationalist government to do is to introduce a eugenic program as part of the pastoral care for our people. And that eugenic program would be one which would try to guide people in their family planning, such that if within their family bloodlines there was a hereditary disease that caused some form of disease or deformity, that could be bred out of their bloodline. And I would say that if somebody has just got a trace of non-white ancestry, which to all other intents and purposes is insignificant, then those non-white genes that they would regard as being unattractive or unwanted, those non-white genes could similarly be bred out of their bloodlines through that same eugenic process.
But wouldn't that just adulterate whoever it was that they were breeding with non-white genes? And you could try and take them out from at the level where they I suppose, DNA manipulation, but if they were breeding with somebody who was white, to try and breed out their non-whiteness, you would just end up making that person that they were breeding with, their offspring, would then be non-white as well. But just to a minute dilution. Wouldn't that be a bit of a problem? It would just end up turning everyone non-white, basically. End up a very dilute amount, but it would still end up looking like India. You know,
What I'm saying is that, if somebody has got, a trace of non-white genes, and they, have a family with somebody else who is, 100% pure white, then, a lot of their children, will actually be 100% pure white. There may be just one child that will still carry that recessive gene. And if where you've got, well, not the recessive gene, but carry that non-white gene. And if you have a eugenic program where, people who carry, undesirable genes are still able to reproduce, but are, encouraged and, led to have fewer children than replacement numbers, whereas people who are of pure white ancestry are encouraged to have larger numbers of children than replacement numbers, then what will happen is that the quantity of undesirable non-white genes within the gene pool will, with each generation, get smaller and smaller and smaller until eventually they disappear.
Ah, right. I understand now. So yeah, so you just encourage them not to breed so much, and until gradually they're gone, and the ones that are white you encourage to breed more, rather than encouraging interbreeding between the two to try and, as it were, lighten the ones that were non-white. So yeah, I understand that. I think yeah, maybe I was getting a little bit confused there. That's a good answer.
Well,
there.
It is a complicated issue, and it's more complicated than a lot of people think. And I think that if you adopt too simplistic a view that you should shun anybody who's got any trace of non-white ancestry, then you are in danger of positioning yourself in such a way that you are then easily able to be portrayed as being cruel and heartless. And I think that if somebody, let's say, has got, is 1/32nd black, for example, and the only trace of blackness within them is that they've got, let's say, frizzy hair, albeit that the hair isn't necessarily black, it might be, you know, brown, or it might even be ginger or something of that sort. If somebody's got that kind of a residual characteristic, then and it's traced back to the fact that they had, as I say, this distant black ancestor, then that trait could be bred out of their bloodline through that eugenic process, and it can be done very sympathetically. You don't have to stigmatize the person, you don't have to make them embarrassed, you don't have to employ any harsh measures or anything of that sort. It can just all be done very humanely and very pleasantly, and the quality of our population can be improved through those means.
That seems reasonable. And so where would they sort of stand with, do you think they should stand with nationalism? Do you think they should be involved with nationalism or not? Or would it depend?
I don't see any reason why not. And what I'm saying is, I'm not saying that somebody who is quite obviously non-white, that they should be incorporated into this category. And so I still stick by what I say, that if somebody looks white, acts white, self-identifies as white, and there's nothing about them to suggest that they're anything other than white. And so therefore, if you have a meeting with somebody and during the course of your conversation with them, there is nothing to suggest to you that they're anything other than white, then that person should be regarded as white. Not really a significant proportion, but there is a sizable minority of people within the white population who probably do have a trace of non-white ancestry. And if you were to check back through their genealogical records, you might find that they have got a black great-great-grandparent or something of that sort, but the genetic inheritance that they have from that person has been, it may be actually be quite insignificant, and it may only result in a very obscure, physical characteristic that might be an embarrassment to that person if it was pointed out, but in to all intents and purposes during the course of their normal everyday life, nobody would actually notice and would have no significant impact upon them.
Okay, I understand that. That makes sense. And I think, you know, in a lot of cases, you get areas that have had a large influx of Muslims, or places that have been taken over by the Ottoman Empire and still part of Europe. And you have to take these people on an individual basis. If they look white, they act white, they identify as white, then they should be taken as white. I agree with you there, Max. What are your views on Jews getting involved in nationalism or getting involved in Western Spring then?
Well, I think that Jews can be regarded in precisely the same way, you know, that what I've just said about if somebody looks white, acts white, self-identifies as white, and nothing about them suggests that they're anything other than white, then we should accept them as white. And I think the same goes with regard to people who perhaps have some Jewish ancestry. I think if somebody is quite obviously Jewish, if somebody acts as a Jew, if somebody self-identifies as a Jew, then they are, by their own actions, demonstrating that they belong to a minority community, which is separate from the white community in which they live. And so they are, by their own, the way in which they live their life, they are demonstrating that they can't be part of the white community. Whereas, if somebody has just got a slight trace of Jewish ancestry, then what I've just said to you with regard to people who've got, mixed non-white ancestry would also apply to Jews. And where I'd say if somebody self-identifies as white with regard to a Jew, because there has been a history of certain Jews hiding their Jewishness and becoming covert Jews, becoming Maranos or Conversos, and secretly still believing themselves as being part of a separate and distinct community from the rest of the white community, and still practicing their religion and working towards achieving a situation where their religion can be openly practiced again in white society. Because there's been a history of that, I think we have to be a little bit more circumspect where Jews come from. And in terms of self-identifying as white, what I would say is that means that the person doesn't belong to any specifically Jewish community, political or religious organizations. They don't practice Judaism, that they've got no significant extended familial links to the Jewish community, that they have no conscious links to the Jewish community, and that they have, in the way that they lead their life, demonstrated loyalty to and concern for the interests of the white race.
That's like somebody that might discover later on in life that they've actually got a Jewish ancestor somewhere, that sort of a situation.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, I have to say that I'm not aware of anybody within Western Spring who is Jewish. And I don't have anybody who's sort of applied to join who would meet the criteria that I've just sort of set out for you. But I think that it's reasonable for us to accept those criteria as a reasonable way of differentiating between people who are obviously part of a community which is separate from and identifies separately to the indigenous white British community, and those people who just incidentally happen to have a small percentage of Jewish ancestry some distance back in the past.
They do come originally from a different ethnic nationality. It's the same with mulattoes, originally from a different ethnic nationality, and due to ignorance and lust in some cases, We've ended up with a bit of a problem with these people that actually don't have an ethnic nationality anymore, and there has to be some way of dealing with them humanely. So I think you've given some good answers there, Max. Well, the next thing that I wanted to get on to was about your speech at the Golden Dawn demonstration, where you were talking about the Greek economy. Now, I was wondering what you see as the ideal economic system and whether Western Spring talk about economic systems at all, or about usury, or what would be the your ideal economic system, Max?
I think as far as the traditional socialist or capitalist kind of polarity that exists within politics, I don't think that it really matters whether your society or the industry and the commerce within your society is entrepreneurially based, whether it's composed of workers' cooperatives or whether it's state-owned. The key question is whether the various facets of your society operate to the benefit of the nation, or whether they don't. And I think that it's a matter for government to judge whether a particular kind of ownership of industry or control of industry is a benefit to the nation. And I can see a situation where you could have an entrepreneurial situation that would be entirely of benefit to the nation, just purely based upon the way in which the people who are the entrepreneurs involved subordinate their desire to make profit to the national interest. Alternatively, you could have an almost identical economic structure where the people involved are determined to make a profit at any expense, and if it means operating against the national interest, then they're quite happy to do that, in which case that would be the kind of economic unit that you really wouldn't want to have in your country. And so things have got to be judged on that kind of a basis. As far as the banking system is concerned, the banking system is based throughout the world on fractional reserve banking. And fractional reserve banking is a corrupt system, and we would want to see fractional reserve banking replaced by full reserve banking in a situation where banking system is nationalised. I think the banking system is such an important important service to the nation that it would be unwise to have it in private hands, and it really ought to be nationalised.
Yeah, I think nationalists would go along with that.
I'll just say, I hope that's not too vague an answer for you. It's basically, yes, we'd like to see the banking system nationalised and full reserve banking introduced instead of fractional reserve banking, because that would then be an honest form of banking. And for banking to be operated on the basis where it just serves the nation by providing a means of for exchanging money and for storing money, which is really what the banking system ought to do, and doesn't get involved in speculation, and shouldn't get involved in all those kind of speculative enterprises. And once you've got that, providing all of the other elements within your economic system operate to the benefit of the nation, then that's the key thing. And it really doesn't matter whether they're entrepreneurial, because entrepreneurial organisations can operate in the national interest. It doesn't matter whether they're workers' cooperatives, because they can operate within the national interest, and it doesn't matter whether they're state-owned. Where they are state-owned, some people say, well, if you have state ownership, it will tend to be unprofitable and tend to lose money. And my answer to that is that really doesn't matter. If we have an industry that's necessary for the national interest, then whether it makes a profit or not, we should still have that industry. It's not a matter that we should dispose of that industry. And if the best hands for that industry to be in are the hands of the state, then it doesn't matter whether it makes a loss. It's still the best thing is still to have it in the hands of the people, make it serve the nation the best and the most effectively.
I think the most important thing is to get rid of usury. And I think a step towards that is to have the full reserve banking, as you were saying. Well, another point that was raised at the John Tyndall Memorial Meeting, and this seemed to be a bit of a theme of the meeting, was unity among the different nationalist groups. And do you know if there have been any steps taken to achieving this, such as a manifesto that all groups could agree to, such as the one that the Baltic nationalist parties have? All three states, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, all the nationalist parties came together and all agreed to this agreement, and they all back one another on this. It's anti-immigration, anti-empire. And I was just wondering if there has been any steps taken to achieving that with the various nationalist groups in Britain.
I don't think there have been any effective steps. A number of people have from time to time called for greater unity in the way that I did. I think, though, that's the, well, certainly from my point of view, the amount of time that I've been able to devote to actually making that a reality has been fairly limited. Some of the people that I've spoken to have responded positively to those kind of ideas. Some people have not responded all that positively. But it's something that I think is an ideal that we need to work towards, but to do so conscious of the fact that it's unlikely to actually happen, certainly for some considerable time. I don't think it will actually happen until one nationalist group becomes an order of magnitude larger than the next largest nationalist group. Once that happens, I think that people will see that there is clearly one group which is showing the way, and they will tend to flock to that one as opposed to remaining in the smaller groups on the margins. And so it's just really a matter of, you know, that I think that there will probably have to be this kind of war of attrition until somebody emerges as the, as the biggest organisation by a clear margin.
There were once.
Sadly, it would be nice if everybody could get together, but I think that there are also personality differences that exist. And one of the things I noticed very quickly when I began working to promote Western Spring was that there are quite a number of people who tend to develop feuds with other people. They will have a difference of opinion, and instead of working to reconcile that difference of opinion, they resort to abusing the other person, which then creates a feud. And there are quite a few people who just refuse to let a feud drop, and they will just persist and persist and persist in pursuing that feud until the day they die, I would imagine. And it's just a sad fact that there are a number of those kind of people within nationalism. I've had people who said that I like everything that you say, but I won't join Western Spring because I know so and so and so and so is a member, and I absolutely hate their guts and couldn't bear to be in the same room as them. And, you know, when you're faced with that kind of a situation, then there's not a lot you can do, really.
People need to be putting their race first, not the individual personalities. It's the race that matters. You know, that's the important thing, is putting your race first. Well, let's move back to Western Spring again now. And I've been interested, there's been a lot of interest in these survival training camps in Wales. They appear to have been very successful, with very positive reports from our side, and there have also been smears from the left. Could you describe some of these activities?
Okay. Yeah, I can do. We call them Legion camps. The Legion camps are organised by my colleague Matt Tate, and they are effectively a lifestyle club which exists to promote certain qualities within our young people that we regard as vital for our future survival and well-being. And so the kind of things that they aim to promote is self-reliance, physical fitness, self-defense, the ability to defend yourself if you're attacked, lots of aspects of self-improvement, One of the camps recently, we had sessions that were on public speaking, for example. We've had sessions that have been on how to construct your CV when you're applying for a job. And there are elements within there which are intended to promote leadership skills, elements that are intended to promote an Aryan lifestyle, and these are effectively to do with religion and philosophy and ethics and things of that sort. And so it isn't a matter that there's anything sinister or overly militaristic about this. I mean, the only thing that could be regarded as militaristic about it is the fact that we teach people self-defense, but, you know, that's not militaristic. That is just self-improvement and to live a safe and full life in a dangerous society.
Just survival skills, really, more than anything else, is survival skills.
We some of the activities involve hiking, involve map reading, orienteering, that kind of thing. They are, again, great ways of building camaraderie, because so often nowadays in this internet generation in which we live, people lead lives where they are dispersed across the country and where they don't, you know, even where they have the opportunity to come into contact with other nationalists for a few hours at a time, it's not often that you get the opportunity to spend several days together with somebody. And it's in that situation where you spend that amount of time where you you build up a far stronger camaraderie than otherwise would be the case.
So it's good for meeting up with people and learning and being in the sort of atmosphere that we want society to be in, really, among nationalists with positive views. Well, that brings us down to the last two questions. We've got some from Nat4UK. You've answered the other ones that he sent in to us. His last two, how do Western Spring propose achieving political power if not through the democratic process?
Okay, I kind of touched on this with regard to the answer to the question about, you know, whether we'd had any associations with the Northwest Front, and I don't know whether I answered that question quite as well as I might have done, but my view is that our society is slowly deteriorating, and that the as it deteriorates and becomes more corrupt. We can already see the way in which our police force is becoming more corrupt, the way in which our civil service is becoming more corrupt, the politicians and all of the political institutions of the country are becoming more corrupt. And as that happens, all of these institutions of the state will diminish in terms of their effectiveness. And what I can see happening is one of two things, or somewhere in between, one of two poles, I suppose, or somewhere in between those two polar events. If the situation in our country slowly deteriorates, and it's slowly deteriorating because we're living through a process of managed decline where the politicians that rule our society are fully aware of the fact that we're going through this process of decline, because this process of decline has political objectives, but they pretend that they're upset about the fact that the National Health Service doesn't work as well as it used to, or that the rail service doesn't work as well as it used to, or that the water supply and the electricity supply doesn't work as well as it used to. They say they're concerned about all these things, but yet they don't do anything to actually correct them. So we're going through this process of managed decline, and the decline could be very, very slow, and it could be that some of the things that people fear, like white people becoming a minority in this country, such as all sorts of things around that kind of scenario, that these things won't actually happen quite as soon as people fear. They may be 50 years or 100 years away, in which case, as we build Western Spring, we could find ourselves in a situation where we could realistically challenge for political power in, say, 10 years' time, in which case we can challenge for political power and we can bring about that political change in a wholly legitimate way and in a way which everybody would applaud and regard as civilized and ethical, etc. At the other extreme end of the scale, we could find ourselves in a situation where, because of the influx of refugees into Europe and into our country, because the refugees that go into the other European countries then become European citizens and then have the ability to come into Britain, and we can't stop them. Because of the massive amount of immigrants that we've got already, the country, we could end up in a situation where our country is driven into an insurgent civil war kind of situation very, very quickly. It could happen within a matter of 5 or 10 years. And I was speaking to a chap who had been who was a British serviceman, and he was serving in Iraq a few years back, and he said that he had been involved in the arrest of an Iraqi insurgent about a month before he was his tour of duty over there came to an end, and he returned to his hometown here in England. And what he said to me was that he was astounded one day to be walking through the shopping centre in his hometown with his wife doing their weekly shop, and he came face to face with this chap that he had arrested, who was an Iraqi insurgent. And this guy had presumably immigrated into Britain as an asylum seeker or as a refugee, and so I'm absolutely positive that that probably wasn't the an unusual case, that that sort of thing probably happens quite often, and that amongst the young men of military age who are preponderantly amongst the immigrants coming into this country, there are going to be lots of them that have got battlefield experience, and for whom the option of resorting to a military solution to any perceived grievance they have with our society will be the first option or a preferred option rather than the last resort that they would turn to. And so the likelihood of this country being plunged into some kind of civil war is a very real possibility. And so in that kind of a situation, I would see within Western Spring, if we've been able to build an organisation and we've been able to acquire as much as possible of the six prerequisites, that we could find ourselves involved in some kind of civil war in order to restore law and order to the country. And that might be the way that we come to power. What I think is most likely, however, is that something in between those two polar extremes will happen, and that what will happen is that the process of managed decline will go on for longer than most of us would like. It won't necessarily go on for 100 years, though, but it will go on for a period of time until a point is reached where the state starts to crumble in its ability to maintain its hold over our society. And we will have then, by that point, built our strength to the point where we will have a very significant amount of public support, where we will have acquired the six prerequisites, and where we will be able to take part in an election that we will win, although not necessarily win convincingly, and where it will then require us to back up that win with a show of force on the streets, in which case that's what we'll have to organise. And it may be that the eventual transition to power comes about as a result of meetings in smoke-filled rooms, to use a cliche, where a certain amount of hard bargaining takes place between ourselves and those people who are clinging to the vestiges of state power.
You're preparing for both eventualities, really. Preparing for
both extremes and anything in between, really. That's, you see, the one thing we can't do is we can't predict the future. So if we're going to make sure that we are best prepared for whatever eventuality occurs, we've got to look at the worst case scenario, look at the best case scenario, and everything in between.
Okay, well, now we come to the final question. Again, this is from Nat4UK. It says, members are required to make higher levels of contributions than other nationalist organisations require, and there have been fears that Western Spring is just a money-making scam. What do you have to say in answer to such fears?
Okay, firstly, what I'd say is that these are fears that are usually voiced by people who regard us as a rival organisation, and they are voiced mischievously. From my own personal point of view, I worked in the financial services industry for most of my adult life, and in order to continue trading in the way that I did up to the point when I retired, I had to have a squeaky clean license. It's very, very it's probably harder to become a financial advisor nowadays than is to become to join virtually any other professional body. And I had a record right up until the time I retired of 100% customer satisfaction. And so I couldn't have achieved that if I wasn't an absolutely honest person. As far as the administration of Western Spring is concerned, we have a board of governors who are effectively the trustees of the money that we collect in. So it's not a matter that that the money goes into a black hole that any one of us can spend willy-nilly without any reference to the others. The money goes into a fund which is administered by the four trustees that are the board of governors. As far as a money-making scam is concerned, well, nobody's getting rich out of Western Spring, I can assure you. I'm certainly not getting rich out of what I'm doing for Western Spring. In reality, personally, I'm getting poorer. Nobody is going to get rich through joining or being a part of Western Spring. People who join us as evangelists and who go out and who recruit and sell will receive an income based upon the volume of contributions that they attract to Western Spring, but that will be an amount which enables them to function and to operate as a full-time activist for us. It won't ever be allowed to reach the point where it becomes an amount of money that enables them to become rich as a result of the work that they do for Western Spring, because that's not the objective. And long before anybody reaches a point where the income that they've been able to generate through recruiting people into our organisation gets to the point where they are substantially financially better off than they otherwise might have been, that will be the point that we will have achieved the six prerequisites, and we will act and we'll save the country. And if we're able to do that, then I don't think anybody's going to actually quibble about the fact that, about the way that it was done. The thing that people have to realize, and that nationalists have to realize, and it's one of the lessons that, is perhaps the hardest for people who are nationalists to actually appreciate. And that lesson is that, much as we might not like it, in our current society, money is power. And if we want to be part of a powerful organisation, and an organisation that's capable of challenging for political power, and you bear in mind that some of the wealthiest corporations and wealthiest individuals in the world are our most vehement enemies and are pitted against us. If we are to stand a chance of succeeding in this world, then we need to recognize the fact that we've got to feed the organization that we belong to with money. And if we don't feed it with money, then we will belong to an organization that operates on a shoestring and has no money and has no power and never will. But if we're prepared to contribute what in effect is a fairly modest amount of money, even so, to Western Spring, for example, then we have the opportunity of belonging to an organization that will eventually accumulate enough money to have the power to succeed. And that's the most important thing.
Well, you've got to be professional about it, and people have got to have their living expenses paid for, and we've got to be credible. We've got to have these credible nationalist groups that aren't just put together by volunteers doing the odd bit when they can, but concentrating on it full time. Well, I've really enjoyed speaking to you today, Max, and I'm sure the listeners would have really enjoyed this as well. Do you just want to tell people where they can find you at Western Spring and how they can contact you?
Yes, the website we have is can be found at www.westernspring.co.uk. Virtually every article has got a form at the foot of it, which enables you to inquire about joining. If anybody is interested in joining, then they can just go to one of those pages, complete that, send it in, and they will be contacted. We have actually been inundated throughout November and December with new applicants, we're very pleased to say. So there may be some delay in somebody getting back to you, but everybody that actually applies for membership will find their application followed up, and we look forward to receiving lots and lots of people wanting to join us.
Okay, Max Messon, thank you very much for being on Aryan Insights.
And thank you, Sven, for giving me the opportunity.
You're welcome.